Well, good morning, everybody. So I knew I was probably, as soon as I posted it, making a mistake. I came across this sign yesterday. You should be excited about church at the Super Bowl. So when your pastor makes a point this Sunday, pour Gatorade over his head. That was what started this. And this morning I've had people just eyeing me like, you ready? You ready? So being an Eagle Scout and being, you know, prepared, I'm going to take my phone off and put it right over here. And I also, something I carry in my bag all the time is my rain hat. It's Gore-Tex, so I should be good to go. I think it's Gatorade-Tex too, you know, but I'll keep that right here just in case I need that. So you open the can of worms, you got to be prepared to eat them, man. That goes for me as well. So anyway, welcome to Glendale Christian Church. It is Super Bowl Sunday, and we like to have a little bit of fun. That's something, you know, I think God has fun, and so we should too. To start our sermon off today, I want to tell a story. This is something that that didn't happen to me. It's a story that's been around for a while, but it's you know, kind of a common thing, you know, for parents to appreciate, where you know, sitting around at the dinner table, you know, your son, dismiss our children. Yes, sorry, Bill was supposed to do that and he didn't. And this is the first week, so you got to give us a little bit of slack, you know, because we're still doing this. So if you're a child, time to go. If parent, if you did not sign one of your children in at the Cornerstone, there's the ability to do that. So, oh, thank you very, very much. Emergency poncho. All right, we're good. I'll keep that right here. Ooh. You know, I'm not on Facebook for like a week, and look what happens. You know, the moment I get on, man, oh, man, I'll just keep that there. That's good. So there's a story. You know, you're sitting at the dinner table, and the son says to his dad, "Dad, I got detention today." And dad says, "Well, why?" And he says, "Well, you know, earlier today, the teacher pointed a yardstick at me and said that there was an idiot at the end of this stick." And so dad says, "Well, how did you get detention from that?" Kid says, "Well, I looked at the teacher and I said, which end?" I'll tell you something. You know, I thought of that story because I have always wanted to be that quick of wit. You know, there's people that just, when something like that gets thrown out, that they have that comeback and it's right there. And they just can throw it out there and it's like in your face and it laugh and all that kind of stuff. And for those of you that know me, that's not me. I'm one of those slow, deliberate thinkers. I take stuff. And so as I was thinking about the kind of person that I am, are there anybody remember watching Seinfeld? You don't have to raise your hand. You don't have to admit it if you don't want to. But there was this character, George Costanza, and there was this one episode where he was in a business meeting, and he was eating a bunch of shrimp, and one of his coworkers just, you know, threw out this burning comment at him, and everybody laughed, and he was there just, you know, seething because he knew, and he didn't have that comeback. And the next scene is he's driving in his car, and he's going along, and then he goes, "Ah, I should have said that." That's me. You know, in case you're wondering, so, you know, no verbal sparring. I debate better than I spar, but that's another thing entirely. It's interesting to me that when we look at Jesus, when we see the way that he interacts with people, he definitely knew exactly the right thing to say at exactly the right moment. And we see encounter after encounter, and we're going to see over the next couple weeks as we lead on. You know, last week, you remember Pastor Andrew preached and did a fabulous job, right? For those of you who were here, you know, he did awesome. And it's sort of, we're reaching the climax of the Gospel of Luke, where we're at right now. And in Jesus, last week, we saw him entering Jerusalem. And this is his last week. This is the Passion Week that we talk about here, the week where, at the culmination of this week, is his death, burial, and resurrection. And Jesus, you know, in a series of encounters we're going to see, is approached by people, and they try to trip him up. They try to throw out some kind of a comment that is just going to make him, you know, lose face in front of everybody. And every time that they do, Jesus has the right answer right there that immediately gets to the root of their rebellion against him. It's awesome. It's epic. Why don't you join me as we have a look at it in Luke chapter 20. We're going to read verses 1 through 18. And the reason I have the hat here is that I am going to make a pointful sermon. Not a pointed, definitely not a pointless sermon. So we're going to do that. I'm ready, though. So if you guys can stay with me, we'll stay and we'll be all right. The authority of Jesus chapter 20, starting in verse 1. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes with the elders came up and said to him, "Tell us by what authority you do these things, or who it is that gave you this authority." He answered them, "I also will ask you a question. Now tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from man?" And they discussed it with one another, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say, 'Why did you not believe him?' But if we say from man, all the people will stone us to death, for they are convinced that John was a prophet." So they answered that they did not know where it came from. And Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." And he began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and let it out to tenants and went into another country for a long while. When the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent another servant, but they also beat and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent in a third. This one they also wounded and cast out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance may be ours." And they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, "Surely not." But he looked directly at them and said, "What then is this that is written? 'The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush them.'" I want to have a look at a couple of things here, because based on what Jesus has been doing, his actions would be considered blasphemy unless he had the authority to do it. And so this section is really about Jesus's authority. But when the Pharisees come to him, the scribes and the elders and that kind of stuff, this isn't some honest thing like, "We're really interesting. Do you have the authority to do this?" They had already made the decision that Jesus did not. They've already made the decision to reject him. And now what they're trying to do in a public confrontation is they're trying to discredit him. And Jesus has the ability to turn it back around. Here's a couple things, points that we see from this. First thing we see is the ministry of Jesus and John the Baptist either comes from the plan of God or the ingenuity of man. Okay, now here's the deal. When Jesus gives his answer, he's not trying to dodge the question. He's not like, "Oh man, that's a really good thing and I can't answer that." What he's trying to do is he's trying to raise the stakes. Okay? He gives them a question that only gives them two options, two possible answers. Either John, and therefore he, are from God, or else they're not. And if they're from God, that's a serious thing. Now, it's hard for us to remember that John, at this period of time, was far more famous than Jesus was. See, for us as Christians, you know, when Jesus, you know, death, burial, and resurrection, that's the foundation of our faith. So we look at him and we naturally think of him. But in this period of time, Jesus brought it back to the person that everybody knew. In fact, there's a Jewish historian, a guy by the name of Josephus, who wrote about this time period. And he spent far more talking about John the Baptist and the impact that John the Baptist made in just a couple of short sentences in there about Jesus. So what Jesus was trying to do is to get people to think, you've got to choose. You've heard John. You've heard me. Now, when you look at those, is this something that comes from heaven or is this the ingenuity of man? It sort of brings up a dilemma, a trilemma, as C.S. Lewis once said. C.S. Lewis once talked about how Jesus could only logically be either Lord, liar, or lunatic. Here's what he said. "I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Lewis says this is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God, but let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. And Lewis concludes in a lengthy portion there from Mere Christianity, it seems to me obvious that he was neither a lunatic nor a fiend, and consequently, however strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God. This was the decision that was placed in front of the people. When they saw John the Baptist, they had the decision whether they believed that John was from God. When Jesus came, you know, prophesied by John and walking in the same way, talking about the same sort of stuff, they had to decide. And they made their decision. We believe he is Lord. We cannot be indifferent to him. We cannot. So what we see with the chief priests and the elders is that where we stand with Christ is often reflected in our decision making. See, the Jewish leadership, their whole discussion reveals something amazing about their character. They were not interested in the truth. The only thing that they were interested in was keeping up appearances in front of the people. They don't believe that either John or Jesus comes from God, but they don't dare say that. You know, they're trying to pander to the people. They want to keep popularity with them. And so even though Jesus is coming, even though John's coming exposed their lack of righteousness, where they had the choice that they could either say, wow, man, I need to get this righteousness and get down on their knees and just, you know, go to God in repentance. They chose not to do that. Instead, they chose to get rid of him. And their biggest thing was, man, we know he's not God. We believe he's not God. But we can't say that in front of the people. Well, we can't, you know, claim that John wasn't a prophet. What we have to do is we've got to do something, you know, that will allow us to be able to you know, pander to everybody. We have to be in line with proper opinion. And so what happens is that they put their selfish interests, their desire to maintain their power base, their desire to maintain their control, their desire to maintain their popularity. And they put that above God's kingdom. And so they lied. Though they knew full well what they believed, they lied to the people because they were unwilling to sacrifice their position. I'll tell you that as Christians today, you know, we look at that. I mean, on one hand, it's a condemnation of the Jewish leadership. You know, they rejected Christ. And so went the leadership, so went a large part of the nation. They rejected him. And we're going to talk about that in the parable in just a second. But I think as Christians, we today can still struggle with this. When we put our selfish interests above God's kingdom. You know, that was the thing that prompted them to figure out what was the PC thing to do. And a lot of times we have that same impulse inside of us where we think that our faith is like an insurance policy. Oh, yeah, signed on the dotted line, you know, paid my dividend, and, you know, when I die, I go to heaven. Done, paid for. But then, you know, basically, as long as we don't do something that's not covered in the policy, you know, whatever sin we think is not covered, you know, by the policy there, you know, we basically are going to get to go to heaven. I mean, if we do certain sins, then we can't. That's the mindset that a lot of Christians have. But what Jesus is challenging us to do is to say, you know, are you going to give me everything? Are you going to, even your interests and that kind of stuff, are you going to let those be under me? Or are you going to keep your things, you know, like, Lord, you can have everything, but I'm holding this stuff right here, whatever that may be. For many of us, it's our time. You know, I work hard during the week, so I must be able to go and do the fun things that I want to do, and God can't touch that free time of mine. I choose what I do with that. I choose the entertainment things that I do and all that. That's mine. You know, God can have everything else, but this is mine. He doesn't get to have my time. For many of us, it's our resources. And we're not just talking about giving an offering to church. You know, as we've seen, where we've looked at when Jesus talks about our financial resources, he's talking about a much broader perspective, a much broader worldview about how we deal with everything that we have. Do we recognize that God is the one who owns it? That the stuff, that every atom of every piece of matter in the universe was created by God. You know, he owns it. He lets us use it for a time. You know, I have little pieces of paper or electrons in a bank account somewhere that, you know, show my little piece of whatever is valuable, you know, that I have. But it's something that I only get to use for a time. None of us take that with us. A perspective on stewardship that Jesus gives recognizes that. And so when we look at what we have, the question is, how are we using it? Are we using it for our own comfort, our own security, to make ourselves, you know, better and buy the things that we want? Are we thinking about God and his kingdom? Are we looking at his priorities and finding a way to be able, you know, yes, to live, yes, to be able to make our living, put food on the table and a roof over our heads and a car to drive and all that stuff, but also to be able to look for this opportunity that we have to serve him? If we have this position that he's God and we're servants, that's a piece of the puzzle. That's something that we're looking to do. When we look at the way we spend our time and our resources, I know that many in our church are doing that. I know a number of you. I mean, and when you look at the things that go on a Sunday morning, you see people giving to the Lord. We have people who set up a cafe with coffee and donuts and set up tables and tear down tables and do that. We have a worship team that practices during the week and that comes here early in the morning to practice, a sound and an AV team that are with them to do that, you know, putting everything together so that this will work. We had communion today. Somebody makes that every week. Without fail. We have people who volunteer to greet people at the door, make sure that they know where to sit, that they can be directed to children's ministry and all of that. And speaking of children's ministry, we have teachers. We have teachers who teach adults. You realize that every one of our elders have a Sunday school class? You know, three of them teach adults, one of them teaches children, but every one of them are preparing every week to teach a Sunday school class. And other people as well, many of you. You know, how many people are a Sunday school teacher here? Look at all these people that are regularly preparing to teach adults, youth, children. The people who staff the Cornerstone and a lot of things. I know people who even outside of even the Sunday and Thursday services that we have give to the church and give to people in the church by going to somebody's house and doing cleaning for them because of age or infirmity that they can't do themselves, or doing yard work, doing repairs. I know people that you know, when they're struggling, and particularly sometimes after surgery or something like that, we have people that go and bring meals to them. We have people who are not able to drive, and they're offered transportation. These are things that go on that a lot of our people are serving in. So here's the thing. I know that a lot of you have caught that vision, but I also know there's some people that haven't. And the challenge that we have in this passage is that, you know, the Pharisees wanted to hold on to their priorities. We're called to give. We're called to give of our time. We're called to give of our resources. And there are tons of needs that we have. There are tons of places to serve. One that I'll highlight, just because we can always highlight this, is children's ministry. We always are struggling to get enough teachers. We have a two-person rule. Every class has got to have two people in it to safeguard and protect the children in there, to make sure that there's no chance that any kind of abuse can occur. That's just a safety thing that we've got to do. That means that every class needs a minimum of two people, and we've got to have somebody else on call if, you know, a kid needs to go to the bathroom or something like that, so there's somebody else that can come in and make sure that we never go below those two people. But there's also a wonderful opportunity. If Jesus calls us to make disciples of all nations, do you think that people this tall need to be made disciples? You know? Some of us don't feel comfortable standing on a street, you know, corner and witnessing, or going up to our neighbors and doing that. You know what? You can be involved in making disciples, making little disciples of all nations by volunteering in children's ministry. Just a need that we have. And I'll tell you, it's a powerful one. You know, every week, as much as I try to pour into my kids, it's so amazing to hear, you know, when Pete comes back and tells me the story that he's heard from Sunday school, that there is some other adult that has poured into his life, that has given him, you know, reinforce the stuff that we're doing at home. But he knows, you know, other than a parent or a teacher, you know, teachers at school do that all the time. They're probably not Christians, right? But that there's somebody that's willing to give up some time so that they can talk to him about Jesus. It makes an impact on him, and I see it daily. Are we willing to be honest about our faith and stand up for our faith? Are we willing to stand for truth? When somebody's going to tell a lie, no, we're going to insist that it's going to be the truth. Are we going to look the other way when someone else is dishonest? Are we going to stand up for the poor, the weak, the downtrodden? Are we going to intervene when someone is mean to another? Are we willing to be people that will be where we're at and not be afraid of what other people are going to think, but do what's true, do what's right? That's what the Pharisees couldn't get. That's what they weren't willing to do. And the contrast in that is that what they failed in miserably, God's calling us to do. Last thing that I want to share with you is that this parable of the tenants teaches us a very interesting thing about God. It tells us that God is long-suffering and patient, but he will judge all who persistently reject him. We have a picture, you know, the vineyard, either representing Israel or else the promise that's been entrusted to Israel. We've got tenants that in this case probably are directed to the Jewish leadership and all the people who follow that leadership. The man who goes away represents God, and the servants that he sends probably are referring to the prophets that God repeatedly sent to the people, calling them to do what they're supposed to do, to be focused on him. When we look at Old Testament history, the nation of Israel repeatedly turned away from God. And, you know, at some period of time, every time I read through the Old Testament, I think, gosh, God, why didn't you come in there and just, you know, whack them right then? What it shows us is the patience of God. And man, thanks be to God for that patience. Because I don't know about you, but I need it. Sometimes I don't get it the first time or the second time or the 300th time. And I need, you know, that patience. Right? But there comes a point where the patience stops. And that's what the main point of the parable. When the man, you know, God, decided that he was going to send his son, the rejection of his son was a big deal. It was a very, very big deal. And it's interesting that Jesus kind of puts a logic behind the thinking, you know, that hey, if we get rid of the heir, maybe we'll be the ones. You know, there'll be no one else to inherit the land. Maybe we'll be the ones that get it. All I have to say is that kind of hope is totally based on wishful thinking. There's no grounding in fact for that. And I can't tell you how many times I interact with people. And, you know, I talk, well, what do you think about God? And, well, you know what? I'm not sure about this organized religion. I mean, I don't believe that God would dot, dot, dot. And whatever that bit is, they've just got in their head this idea of what I think a good God would do. And a good God would never do this kind of thing. Tell you what, why don't we see what God himself says that he's going to do? Because the follow-up question that I usually give is, man, that's an interesting idea. Where did you get that? And that's where I get the hemming and the hawing. Oh, well, I mean, you know, that's just a good thing. It's like, whoa, time out. What on earth has convinced you that God relates to people that way? Have you got a message from him? Did he speak to you? You know, because this book contradicts that. If this genuinely is a message from God, as it claims to be, that's not the way that God works. There's an accountability for us. A lot of times we mistake the patience of God for indulgence. We kind of have this idea that he's like that you know, grandparent that would always give you the treats and that kind of stuff, and you could never do anything wrong. You know, they would always accept you, and you know, you never have any problem there. What we miss is that God is patient. God gives us a long time period to learn. But if we persist in that disobedience and we don't change our thinking, it's not indulgence. Judgment is coming. Probably the ancient hearers, when they heard this parable and when immediately thinking about it, were like, dude, why did the master send three servants? You know, I would have sent the first servant and they sent him away empty-handed, you know, and I would have sent the hit squad out to go take them out, and then boom, we're going to get some people who are doing it. Ancient people would have been thinking about that. But you know what? Did you notice their response? Jesus says this and says that the master will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Why did the people say, oh, surely not? It's because that's the point that they realize Jesus was talking about their leadership. You know, it's okay if it's just a story about, you know, something and that. I mean, I'm tracking with you. And then once they realize, dude, that's the leadership. No. Whoa, what happened? And even that jarring thing didn't get them to look and to honestly consider where Jesus was coming from and what he was saying. God's word tells us, the times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. That's Paul's proclamation in Athens. Judgment is coming. And Jesus, in this passage, talks about this image of the stonemason. You know, that you're going to build a building and you need a cornerstone. Two walls are depending on that cornerstone to be true. And it's like the stonemasons are going along and they see this stone and they're like, yeah, I don't want that one. Put that in the discard pile. We're not going to use that one at all. They have rejected it. And it turns out that when the building that they've built for themselves crumbles, that this one is the one that God's going to take, put in. This is going to be the cornerstone. This is going to be the thing upon which everything is based. And it's a stone that people will stumble on. It's a stone, you know, using another image of a stone from the book of Daniel, God's kingdom is portrayed as a stone that will come in and smash everything that's in opposition to it. This is the warning that Jesus gives. So there's two parts to this, I think, and that is that when we hear this, Jewish leadership rejected Christ. If you have not committed your life to Christ, if you're not sure where you stand with him, this is something you got to wrestle with. This is something you need to be honest to yourself about. And a lot of times when I talk with people and they say, oh, well, I'm not sure I believe in that, and they give objections, what they're really struggling with is they don't want to give up a lifestyle. They don't want to give up, you know, the freedom to do their own thing. They don't want to be responsible to another. That's the thing that's really in the heart. And they, oh, well, I'm not convinced that, you know, the Big Bang, you know, can be explained by anything other than naturalistic, you know, and they give all this stuff. We can argue and we can talk about that stuff. There's very, very plausible reasons to believe that the universe is created. But a lot of times that's a smokescreen. The real heart of the matter comes down to when I ask somebody who Jesus is, in their heart of hearts, are they willing to accept him or are they willing to reject him? And if there's a sense, because every one of us probably start at that point where we're not sure where we stand with Christ, but at some point we hear something, at some point we think about something, at some point we read something from God's word, and God touches our heart. There's something that happens where we just realize, wow, the truth is, I'm denying him. I'm rejecting him. And I know it's true. My mind tells me that it's true. I just need to catch my heart up with that. Some people in Israel got that. I want to challenge you that if you're on the edge, you're not sure where you stand with Christ, or maybe you've not committed your life to him. The way we start is by talking. I can't force you to believe. I don't want to force you to believe. God gives you the freedom of choice. But if you've got an objection, if you've got something that you want to talk about, if there's something that's just holding you back, and some people do have that, you know, just, man, I don't know the answer to this, and I really struggle with this. Cool. Come and talk to me. You know, come and meet me after service. I'll give you one of my business cards. Well, I'll first run out and go grab them, and then I'll come, you know, but I'll give you one of my business cards, and I'll put my number on it. We can meet for coffee, my treat, and we can just talk. Because I'd love to be able to walk through that. I'd love to be able to help you think through maybe something that you haven't considered. I put a lot of effort and study into this, and I don't have all the answers. I'm going to tell you that right off the bat. If I don't have an answer, I'm not going to try to BS my way through it either. I will tell you full on, here's, you know, I don't know. Let me go look at that. Let me go think about some things, and let's get back together. But let's talk. Let's see if we can figure that out. And so that you can make an informed decision. Because if this is true, if what Jesus is saying is true, judgment is coming. And the time for Jesus' return is closer today than it was yesterday. I don't know when it'll be. It could be next week, tomorrow, today for all that matter. Could be not in our lifetime, not in our grandchildren's lifetime. I don't know. What I do know is that we have a call to be ready whenever it comes. But I'd like to talk to you about that. If you're a believer, one of the things that I hope that this challenges us to do is to look and see, are we in any way acting like the Pharisees? Are we holding on to stuff that we just don't want God to have? Because if Jesus is Lord, eventually we need to get down on our knees and acknowledge that. And anything that we hold back, anything that we refuse to give him, is something that incurs his displeasure, not something that he approves of. Let me ask you guys, closing with a final song. Yeah. because we've got the Super Bowl today and people are preparing for that, we are not doing our usual second hour Sunday school classes. So as soon as we're done here, you can go home, make your bean dip or whatever it is that you make for the Super Bowl. I'm working on a car today, so if I get that done, I might catch part of the game. Otherwise, car needs to get done first. So, hope that you have a good time today with friends and family doing that. The Lord be with you. We will be back with Sunday school classes next week and all of that. So join us for that.